Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton, sitting in for your regular host, David Inge. Glad you could listen. Henry Frain is at the controls, and our producers are Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal. During this hour of the show, we'll talk about the question, can freedom of the press survive media consolidation? That's also the title of a conference occurring this week for 2 days here on the campus of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. This conference is free and open to the public. We'll talk about the issue that it raises and also some of the details about who is speaking in this conference. Just to mention a few, Seymour Hersh, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, Representative Bernie Sanders of Vermont, Naomi Klein, Robert McChesney, who's one of our guests this morning, and others. So we'll talk about that as well as with our guests, Bob McChesney, who is a conference organizer, and he's also a professor at the Institute of Communications Research here at the University of Illinois, author of numerous books about the media and democracy. Also joining us is Ben Scott. He is policy director of Free Press, and he's here from Washington, D.C. to participate in the conference. Also, he's speaking at the conference, and we'll talk with him during this hour of the show about a variety of things that the conference will touch upon. As we talk with Bob McChesney and Ben Scott, we invite you into the conversation. All you have to do is pick up the telephone and call us, the number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. And in case you didn't know, by the way, Bob McChesney is also the host of the program Media Matters, which airs here on WYLL AM every Sunday from 1 to 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And I'm sure many of you are familiar with him from that show as well. To both of you, good morning.
Good morning, Jack. Great to be here.
Morning, Jack.
Good to see you, Ben. And Ben was also the first producer of Media Matters.
Indeed. Indeed. That shows that working for Media Matters leads to great things in your life.
All right. Well, that's good. So the conference kicks off tomorrow. Why don't you, I'll invite you to tell us about it.
Sure. I'd be glad to. This conference The long and short of it is that roughly a year ago, we started a group in the Institute of Communications Research called the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research. And the idea of this group is to encourage work on media policies, to encourage scholarship on it, to connect young scholars, PhD students, with policymakers and activists so the work can have more relevance and pertinence to the crucial issues that are being decided around the world today and the shape of our media and communication system. And part of this process was having an annual conference to take up issues and take up an annual conference, not only to take up issues, but for the general public, not just for insiders, but to try to, you know, draw the public into these issues that are of such great public importance. And oftentimes the public doesn't get to participate in them. I think that's part of the problem we have. And this idea for the first conference was dealt with media consolidation, because that's been such a crucial issue for the past several years, as we've seen fewer and fewer firms buy up more and more of the media. And so many Americans across the political spectrum are deeply concerned about the homogeneity of content, the decline of journalism in our commercial media, that it seemed like a natural. And there's so much interest in it. And the other good thing about this issue for doing a conference on it is that there's not like there's just one answer or one way to look at it. And so we've brought together 15 or so very prominent figures from academia, from journalism, from the entertainment community, policymakers, activists, and said, look, you answer this question any way you want to. I mean, you take off on it. You've done a lot of work in this area. Let's hear what you have to say. So it's not scripted. We have no idea what you know, Naomi Klein's going to say, or what Phil Donahue is going to say.
Or Dennis Swanson, the head of Viacom.
Dennis Swanson, right. The head of Viacom. We have no idea what they're going to say, but they're going to say interesting things. Mm-hmm. The one thing we know for sure is what we've got are, in that lineup, maybe if you made a list, I made a list of the 10 best speakers I've heard in my life, 5 or 6 of them are going to be at this conference. It's an extraordinary group of gifted communicators.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it kicks off tomorrow night with none other than Seymour Hersh, who has, I think, 2 Pulitzer Prizes.
I mean, they ought to just name it after him.
Yeah.
I mean, the guy's, you know, he's just in a whole different class than any other investigative journalist when it comes to military and national security matters. I mean, he's the gold standard. And he was on Media Matters yesterday. People probably follow his work in The New Yorker. He broke the My Lai scandal that really changed much of the Vietnam War's course.
Mm-hmm. Almost that was the first Pulitzer was for the My Lai.
Yeah. Story. And his work is just legendary. So we're honored to have Seymour Hersh here to speak at 5 o'clock tomorrow in Krannert. But, you know, we've got people like Amy Goodman, who a lot of our listeners know, or Naomi Klein, Orville Schell, who's the dean of the Berkeley Journalism School, who mm-hmm. is, you know, one of the leading figures in sort of protecting and preserving viable journalism in this country. I think people are going to find top to bottom, this is a lineup without any weak spots. We don't have any 220 hitters in this lineup. You know, you got to hit 320, you're not making the roster.
Okay. I think it's tomorrow at Folinger, isn't it?
Tomorrow's Folinger, 5 o'clock okay. is Seymour Hersh. Then right. at 7:30 is going to be Representative Bernie Sanders from Vermont, Amy Goodman and Naomi Klein. Okay. And that's also in Folinger. And the following day, all the events, they run all day long, take place during the day in Krannert. And it's which room in Krannert is that?
At the Festival Theater in
the
Krannert.
Festival Theater. You can't miss it, though. You'll yeah. see everyone there. And right. we've got basically four sessions. And each session will have three or four people talking, 15, 20 minutes, then Q&A. And quickly, the first session we've got mm-hmm. And let me get the list here so I don't blow it. But the first session we have, Wednesday morning at 9 o'clock in Krannert, Seymour Hersh again, Linda Foley, the president of the Newspaper Guild, who's a dynamic speaker and really at the center of the concern of how lack of local ownership and concentration of ownership has leveled newsrooms across mm-hmm. the country, just is clear-cut journalist jobs and the lack of journalism. Orville Schell, who I mentioned from UC Berkeley, and also in that first session Wednesday morning, it's going to be Danny Goldberg. Now, some of our listeners might be familiar with him. He's one of the legendary figures in the music industry. He's now the president of Air America Radio. And he's going to talk about the effort to set up a sort of a liberal commercial talk radio network and the problems they've had and also the great successes they've had. The session after that at 10:45 in Krannert has three speakers. And this session, this is going to be a barn burner. Phil Donahue, John Nichols has been a frequent guest of mine on Media Matters, one of my dear friends and a co-author, and Naomi Klein, again, who will speak Wednesday as well as Tuesday night. Then after lunch at 1:45, we've got Len Hill, who's one of the legendary Hollywood producer, Dennis Swanson, as you mentioned, president or one of the leaders at Viacom, Roberta Baskin, who's the head of the Center for Public Integrity. This is one of the great investigative journalist groups in the country. Chuck Lewis used to be the head of it. Right. She's been on Media Matters. They do the best research on corruption of public policy, the link of industry and policymakers across the board in Washington. And Paul Jay, who's a Canadian, he's sort of the Canadian Bill Moyers, and he's trying to start an international independent world television, he calls it, to be an English language news channel without advertising, supported by listeners and viewers with small donations that will do high quality journalism. Similar, I guess the comparison might be to something like the BBC, but even less attached to British elites than the BBC would be. I mean, it would be purely independent of any elite political class because it would be transnational. It's a very provocative idea, and he's a very interesting man and a great journalist in his own right. And then the final session on Wednesday, May 11th in the Krannert Festival Theater at 3:30, we'll have Ben Scott, who's in the studio with us today. And Ben, the policy director at Free Press, knows more about what's happening in the key media issues in Washington than anyone I know. Amy Goodman will be back to reprise her presentation from Tuesday night and talk again. Amy Goodman, one of the greatest speakers who's ever spoken. And Bill Fletcher, the head of Trans-Africa Forum, who was formerly a high-up official in the AFL-CIO, and has been one of the most thoughtful people politically about the relationship of the African-American diaspora or the African diaspora in the United States and the Caribbean to the politics of Africa. And also he's been very heavily connected to the labor movement in this country. So he brings a lot of different perspectives on the issues that we're talking about and thinks a lot about media and politics.
Great. Quite a lineup. Well, and also let's mention again that this is free and open to the public beginning tomorrow at 5 o'clock at Folinger Auditorium with Seymour Hersh and a panel discussion to follow from 7:30 to 9:30 p.m. tomorrow night. And then Wednesday at Krannert Festival Theater beginning at 9 a.m., the lineup that you just mentioned.
That's right. And you know, it is on the web for people who weren't taking notes at home. You just go to www.iimpr.org. All the information, who's speaking and the locations is there.
Okay. We have several callers waiting, and I want to include them in our conversation. Let me just quickly reintroduce our guests. Bob McChesney, professor at the Institute of Communications Research here at the University of Illinois, host of Media Matters. Ben Scott, policy director of Free Press in Washington, D.C. And we'll get Ben into the conversation, but we also have some callers waiting. And I'm sure we'll talk about some of the substantive issues that are raised by the provocative question that is the title of the conference. Let's talk with some callers.
Sounds good.
First up, someone in Urbana, line number one. Good morning.
Is that me?
Mm-hmm.
Am I the, yes. I'm an electrical engineering professor at the university, and I just wanted, has a reputation of being a conservative group. It's true. It's a majority of Republicans. But even within engineering, there are a lot of people that have been upset, say, before the war, for example, with the poor media coverage. First of all, let me just thank Bob McChesney and the other organizers for putting this conference together. Perception is, let me just step back a bit. My perception is that around that time, we went from almost no introspection at all on WILL radio and other places about the history of what led up to the war, the energy connections, the fact, you know, all sorts of issues. Larger issues up to the war, and now things have changed completely. We have Media Matters, which is an incredible show, which has in-depth analysis every week, and there are other shows on WILL as well. And I just wondered, there's a lot of questions there. I mean, what kind of policy changes went on at WILL? Is there a lot of flack that the radio station is receiving now because of this criticism of policy? I just would like to just get a better feeling of what's happened over the last 3 or 4 years to change policy at WLL, and what's happening with any death threats.
Well, I guess I better answer that to the extent I can. This is Jack, the host. I don't think there has been any policy change. To be honest, I really don't. I think that WLL has always been a place where we explore a range of perspectives and try to go in depth as much as we can on a wide variety of issues. And, you know, as someone who's been a producer here for going on 18 years, I think, you know, I take pride in the fact that we've taken flack from all sides. And I think we are very serious and very very determined to try to provide balance and, you know, to the extent that we can and you know, by tapping a lot of different resources and a lot of different people. So I'm not sure if that answers the question.
Well, you know, let me just say something. Thank you for the nice words, by the way. This is Bob McChesney. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that when I came to move here in 2001, when I moved down here from Madison and I pitched this idea for a show here at WILL, you know, I had no luck pitching this idea to a show to the NPR station in Madison. I mean, they wouldn't touch it with a 10-foot pole. I don't think many other stations would. And the people here were supportive from the get-go. They had heard copies of the show I'd done on the community station in Madison. And I said, yeah, that sounds like it'd be a pretty good show. And I think they have taken some heat, but they keep me protected. They're what a good medium should do. They put a firewall up so I don't have to deal with a lot of people who are really cranky. In fact, I rarely hear about it unless I ask. Mm-hmm. And they've been exceptionally supportive, and I think the show's been well received. I think that helps. I mean, obviously listeners like it, and so it's been successful. But there's the important point of this policy-wise to understand is it's an NPR affiliate. It's a public station where I'm doing a show like this, where we can have this conversation. We're not getting this conversation on commercial radio stations yet, if we ever will. And this is one of the reasons why I think public broadcasting is under sharp attack now. And this is a good chance to bring Ben Scott into the discussion, who's joined us here, because Ben Scott in Washington is in the midst now of what's emerging is, I think, really a major, even seminal fight over the future of public broadcasting in the United States. Ben?
That's absolutely true, Bob. You get a lot of talk in Washington these days about how the public broadcasting system, both PBS and NPR, are broken, that they're rampant with bias and unrepresentative of the opinions of the American public. Politicians stand on their platforms and rant about this all the time. The current chairman of the board of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting has made it his personal mission to monitor the content of public broadcasting and ensure that the conservative points of view are represented in equal parts with liberal points of view, and has made the claim that the American public is tremendously dissatisfied with public broadcasting. And the fact is that is totally untrue when you look at the figures. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting in 2003 and 2004 went out to the country and did a poll. And they hired a Republican pollster, and they specifically asked the question of the public, of over 1,000 people in a statistical sample, do you agree or disagree, do you believe that public broadcasting, PBS and NPR, are fair and balanced? 80% of the country said yes, they agreed that public broadcasting was fair and balanced. 8% had no opinion. 12% said they felt it was not fair and balanced. And of that 12%, about a third felt that it was biased too far to the right. So it seems to me that all of the attacks on public broadcasting that are going on in Washington are largely about fixing a system that isn't broke, that's doing the kind of work that local publics appreciate, that's putting the kind of serious journalism and culture on the air that people need, that people want, that they're not finding in the commercial system. And it is up to us at the ground level to respond to the criticism of our local stations with the support that they deserve.
You know, there's one other point that I feel compelled to make about this, and that is, since news has basically disappeared from the rest of the airwaves,
yeah,
and there's really no serious discussion of issues really anywhere else, quite frankly, on the air, that is, it sounds kind of strange to people to hear what we do sometimes. I mean, that's my perception.
Just even talking about politics is biased now. If you're not talking about a celebrity's sex life.
I'm afraid it is. I'm afraid it does seem that way. And you know, I have to say that, you know, that's a problem. Because if we can't, you know, as a democratic nation, if we can't discuss real issues honestly, you know, we can't remain a democratic nation. So, you know, I think it's important that all sides are examined, and I think we take that mission very seriously. We didn't come here today to talk about that, but you know, that's the point I would make.
I think you go right back to the title of the conference: Can Freedom of the Press Survive Media Consolidation? Well, one of the primary solutions to the problem of media consolidation is support for a robust non-commercial media sector, and that includes, of course, public radio and public television, and the kind of media outlets that provide the content and journalism and culture that you're simply not getting in the commercial world that's dominated by a handful of consolidated corporations.
Caller, want to follow up at all?
No, thank you very much. I would like to just say that definitely no attack on WILL. I think that our local radio station is doing a beautiful job. I appreciate it. Thank you.
All right, thank you so much. A couple of the callers waiting, and we welcome others. If you'd like to join us, 333-9455. Toll free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. Another caller in Urbana, line number 2. Good morning.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I have three questions I was hoping you could address. The first was, I was wondering if you could discuss the change in the funding structure of public radio, moving from more government sources to more individual and corporate contributions, and any effects that that might have on news coverage. The second is that it seems that most people who are politically to the left are concerned about media consolidation, but I was hoping you could discuss reasons why conservatives and moderates should be concerned about it too. And then I was also hoping you could address the role of small local stations like WEST in fighting against media consolidation, and I'll listen off the air.
Okay, thank you.
Wow, those are great questions. Let me start by answering number 2. I'm going to let Ben talk about number 1 when I'm done with that, if that's okay with Ben. And maybe we can both take number 3. But the first part, one of the most heartening things I think that's taken place with media policy, politics in the past few years, is that it really does cut across the political spectrum. The whole idea of media policy activism in this conference is that the core policies that put the media system in place should be subject to open and public debate. And whatever your political views, if you believe in democracy, you should believe that. You shouldn't be giving out monopoly licenses and franchises and subsidies behind closed doors. The public, it's made in our name. It should have our informed consent. And conservatives believe that as much as liberals or people who are not political. That's not a partisan position. That's just a commitment to a constitutional rule and effective self-government. And one of the things we've discovered in the past few years is beyond that point, when the Federal Communications Commission tried to relax media ownership rules in 2003, and there were people on the FCC who wanted to basically get rid of them and allow a single company more or less to own all the media in one community. So you'd have company town media, you'd have one newsroom fits all, basically the end of viable local media in this country. But we found out that people who are self-described political conservatives didn't like this at all. I mean, this was not something that conservatives in Decatur, Illinois were jumping up and down saying, this is great. I want to let Clear Channel own every media in our city. They hated that idea. In fact, the only conservatives who really liked it were the ones who were connected to the big money corporations that were getting paid off by them, the politicians in Washington, the Bush administration. But rank and file conservatives said, this is crazy. We like the idea of having local media ownership. We like the idea of having competition in markets. And we like the idea of having these policies made out in the public, not corruptly behind closed doors, where the public gets a chance to weigh in. We don't like the sleaziness that goes with these media policies, with these big media companies, you know, flossing their teeth with the politicians' underpants, which is basically what's been going on. And in the campaign of 2003, Ben, you can correct me if I'm wrong, we got roughly 3 million people to email, telephone, write to the FCC or Congress protesting media consolidation. I'm willing to bet a good third of those came from self-described political conservatives, including some of the political conservative groups like Brent Bozell's operation, which I disagree with on virtually every other issue. But on this issue, he said, we're in agreement here. We have to have lots of media owners. A free press can't work with consolidation, and it can't work with absentee owners. The whole system's predicated on local ownership and competitive markets whenever possible.
Well, I think I saw in the midst of that letter-writing campaign a letter from Wayne LaPierre of the National Rifle Association, who was allied with the ACLU, which was just
I'll tell you a funny story. I don't want to get off this too much, but, you know, the Free Press website, we were just getting underway then. You know, every time a conservative would come out against media consolidation, there were a lot of them. We'd plug them on our front page or website. And so once we had like Jesse Helms and Wayne LaPierre and I know Strom Thurmond, was he still alive? But we had a bunch of these guys on our homepage, and I had a friend of mine from like the 70s got a hold of me and said, Bob, what's happening? You become another David Horowitz or something? What's with this webpage? You know, it looked like I was on the far right of the Republican Party. But the point simply was that across the spectrum, Trent Lott, people get it. I mean, if you like media, a viable free press system, and you believe in it in this country, it depends on having locally owned media as much as possible. I mean, all media, you can't have locally owned film studios maybe, but if you don't have locally owned radio stations and TV stations and newspapers, you know, it just doesn't work. It just doesn't work.
Did you want to follow up, Ben, on the other issue, I guess?
Let me follow up briefly. I think, you know, the main point about whether media consolidation is a left or a right issue, it's neither. Media consolidation is an issue for anyone who feels like they don't see themselves on television and they don't hear their own voices on the radio. Anyone who feels like in any way that they're underrepresented needs more media, not less. And to have more media, we need more independent voices in the media system. And that's sort of the baseline value that we operate from. I think to get to the caller's first question about the changes in the funding structure for public radio, it's a very difficult problem. And anyone who has listened to public radio for any period of time recognizes the amount of corporate underwriting has increased dramatically over the last 10 years. And the reasons why that happened are complex, but it comes down to a basic catch-22 for public radio. In the 1960s, when the public broadcasting system was first developed by the federal government, it was a no-brainer in the American public that the federal treasury should support a non-commercial media sector that did public service journalism and public service culture. There was no disagreement between the public and their politicians. It was something that was agreed upon and ought to be fully funded. Now, over the course of the last generation up to the present day, as NPR has dramatically increased its listener base, NPR is currently the only broadcaster, television or radio, I believe, who has an increasing audience. Let me say that again because it is remarkable.
Mm-hmm.
NPR is the only broadcaster, commercial, non-commercial, television or radio that has an increasing audience. That's a remarkable statement in this day and age as we diversify our media system into cable TV and the internet.
That's true locally as well for WILL,
and
by the way.
Satellite radio too.
Yeah.
And this leads to the paradox. As NPR has grown in its influence and has done high-quality investigative journalism, has done high-quality culture, its political opponents have put pressure on the government to decrease the funding that goes into the coffers. That there has grown in Washington a disconnect between what the politicians are willing to put forward in terms of appropriation for the NPR budget and what the public wants. And as that disconnect swells, the budget shortfall for public radio stations increases and forces public radio stations to go to their listeners and really lean on the listener base to support them, which is, of course, a legitimate source of funds and a very, very important one. But we have to ask ourselves, you know, why is it that there's this money shortfall? And it has partly to do with the political pressures in Washington, but also partly to do with the commercial broadcast lobby, which says to the politicians, you know, hey, you know, NPR's got this increasing audience. They're doing all this great work. They're essentially competing with us. You know, why are you giving federal dollars to a competitor of commercial radio? know, what's going on here? You're going to have to take them off the federal dime, or else we're going to, you know, bring our lobbying dogs right down on top of you, politicians who need us to run their advertising during campaign seasons. And the budgets get cut, and then NPR has to go to corporate underwriters to fund their programs. And the commercial broadcasters come back around and say, hey, you know, they're competing for our advertising. Not only are they competing for our content and our audience, they're competing on our advertising. So both of these pressures undercut the political will to put money into the coffers of public broadcasting. So it's a sort of catch-22 for public radio. The better you do, the more likely you are to lose money. And the more you lose money, the more you have to go and get corporate underwriting. And the more you get corporate underwriting, the more the lobbyists on the commercial side tell you you're a competitor and you ought to get off the federal dime. So it's a real conundrum, and it's a difficult cycle to get out of. And we've been stuck in this pattern for about a decade and a half now.
Oh. The only solution to it's going to be to get the discussion out of Washington and behind from these closed doors, where these politicians say they represent the public, but basically have their own agendas, and that's really what's going to happen the next 2 or 3 years. There's a movement to have communities around the country have their own hearings, let the people come out and say what they want from their media system in general, what they want from their public broadcaster in their community, and I think if the people of the country's voices are heard, we will have healthy, strong support for good quality public broadcasters in every community in this country.
A quick footnote to that. One of the sources of strength for public broadcasting is obviously our listeners, who just demonstrated again what a strength they are by their response to our pledge drive last week. So thank you for that. I want to get on to our next caller, but let me quickly reintroduce our guest this morning, Bob McChesney, professor of the Institute of Communications Research at the University of Illinois College of Communications, and also Ben Scott, policy director at the Free Press. We're talking about a conference that kicks off tomorrow evening. Can freedom of the press survive media consolidation? 5 o'clock tomorrow, Seymour Hersh will give the opening talk. And that's at Fullinger Auditorium on the campus of the University of Illinois. And then on Wednesday morning at 9 a.m., a series of panel discussions gets underway at the Krannert Center at the Festival Theater at Krannert. And so that is free and open to the public. If you would like to attend, you are more than welcome to do so. We have one caller waiting and time for others. If you want to join our conversation this morning, 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free anywhere else, 800-222-9455. We have actually several callers. We'll go next to an Urbana listener on line number one. Good morning.
Line number one?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. One question, actually two questions. The first one is, why wasn't Ralph Nader invited? Or if he was, is something wrong with him? I haven't heard. Certainly Phil Donahue would have been delighted to have had him at this conference. And second, why doesn't WILL pick up Amy Goodman so that a progressive voice can get out to the masses beyond Champaign County and our little island of progressivism here? And I'll hang up and let you go. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Well, you know, I didn't think of inviting Ralph. I know Ralph pretty well. Basically, we had I wanted a member of Congress to come for our politicians, and I wanted a member of the FCC. Ideally, Michael Copps couldn't come. Jonathan Edelstein couldn't come because they had voting duty midweek they couldn't miss. And we were able to get Representative Bernie Sanders, who's been a leader on this issue. And that was my thinking there, because they only have a handful of slots, and I didn't want all policymakers. So that was the thinking there. Phil Donahue, as the caller accurately points out, is a major fan of Ralph Nader's, worked for him in the 2000 campaign, still has great respect for him, I know, and will articulate that position. I'll tell you a funny story about Phil Donahue. He, when he saw this conference, he just wanted to come on his own. He said, I'm buying tickets. I've made my plans. I'm just going to come to attend it. And I said, well, Phil, if you're coming to Urbana, you're talking. You aren't going to just sit in the audience. He was so excited. He's a really special person.
That's great. I'm not sure how to answer the question about Democracy Now! On WILL. It's really an area that would be, you know, a subject for Jay Pierce, our program director, and actually he's also our station manager, doing both jobs. Let me quickly add also that on Focus on Wednesday this morning, speaking of FCC commissioners, Jonathan Edelstein is going to be on – Edelstein, pardon me – is going to be on the show at 10 o'clock.
Terrific.
Yeah. Is he here for the conference, or is he just...
No, but he will be in St. Louis for the conference we haven't spoken about yet, which is the big National Media Reform Conference. It'll be St. Louis from Friday, Saturday, and Sunday this weekend. And that's going to have 2,000 or 3,000 people, and it will have Jonathan Edelstein and Michael Copps both there, along with lots of people from the area.
Great. Well, we'll mention that again, as well as a way people can find out more information. We have lines all full. We'll go on next to another Urbana listener, line number 2. Good morning.
Is that me?
Yes.
Okay. I'd like you to comment, if you would, on the difference in funding between CPB, NPR, PBS, and what goes on in the UK with the BBC. And I have a sense that the not only is the funding much larger for the BBC, but the per capita funding is much, much larger, and that nevertheless, in England, they still manage to support private media like ITN and Channel 4. And I also have the sense that the BBC sort of sets a standard to which these private media have to adhere. So if you could comment on that, I'd appreciate it. And I'll take my answer. I'll just hang up and listen.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'll take that one really quickly because I don't want to go into a lecture. But I mean, the important thing to understand is that not just Britain, but really every country in the world that has a viable public broadcasting system has a very different approach to funding and management than the United States has. And there's not any one way. Holland has a different mechanism. Germany has a different mechanism. Norway does from Britain. The British system might not be best for a country our size physically. It's ideal for a country that's physically the size of a postage stamp, basically. It's a very small country. But what they do in Britain with the BBC historically that makes it so much better than our system is two things. First of all, they have a big public hearing every 10 years to discuss what they want from the BBC. And the public weighs in and it sets out the broad parameters of public control and the guidelines that are given to management of the BBC. And these are heavily publicized. They're covered in the media. They're big deals. Everyone in the country knows what's going on. And they produce white papers and reports, and they're voted on by Parliament, and budgets are set for the next 10 years as a result of this. But then once that's been done, the public's had to say, it gives the people who run the BBC a lot of autonomy. It doesn't then – so you don't have a politician wake up and say, I didn't like that story last night. Now I want to close you down today. So if you're doing your work, you know you're publicly accountable, but you get some room to operate. And that produces a much better media product than feeling like there's a censor hanging a sword over your neck every night when you file a story. As for funding, the caller's absolutely right. If we supported public broadcasting on a per capita basis in the United States to the same extent the British support the BBC, our public broadcasting would be the biggest media company in the country. It would be, in a domestic thing, it would be bigger than Disney or Time Warner or Rupert Murdoch's News Corporation. It would be between roughly $15 and $18 billion revenues. That would be enough money to not only support an amazing national radio and television network, but to have money to do great local work in community after community with journalists. You know, not one journalist scrambling around to cover 18 stories, but a fleet of journalists, a great newsroom. It would spawn entertainment coverage. It would be giving jobs to artists and filmmakers that like in Britain. I mean, one of the great benefits of public broadcasting in other countries is they spur on a production sector that wouldn't exist without it. They do great work. They launch careers. They launch new ideas. It's a very healthy part of the media culture. We could do all that. And we have the money and resources to do that. We just don't have the political will.
Yeah. I think the caller also makes an interesting point that the BBC sets the standard in the UK for the other television networks that are on the air. In recent years, we've heard a lot about the cable news networks and the foxification of the cable news networks. As one channel that becomes commercially successful produces a particular style of journalism and broadcasting, the other channels follow suit to try to capture the same market. Well, that process happens in the UK. You have the BBCification of English broadcasting, but it's a positive cycle in that case because the BBC keeps everybody else honest. You can't put out schlocky journalism if you're in England, because if you do, people will just switch the channel and watch the BBC. We don't have that kind of budget for PBS and NPR in the United States, and so they don't have that sort of – they do have that sort of impact to a degree, but not to the degree that some of us might like. I think it's important to point out that in terms of budgets, the advertising budget alone at HBO is more money than the production budget at PBS.
Our lines are all full, so let's go on and talk with some more listeners. We'll go next to someone in Champaign on line number 3. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi.
Yes.
I'm a big fan of WILL.
Thank you.
But I have to say they constantly misrepresent their funding situation. A couple years ago, and you can tell me this is true or false, a couple years ago they got a lot of money from the Campbell family to build the Campbell Hall. And because their amount of money coming in increased, their matching funds increased. So there was an increase in their budget, and they put on more people. Then when the Campbell money ran out, because there was no matching funds to continue, their budget decreased. So their big funding push was to wail and moan and cry, oh, we've had our funding cut. Our funding's been cut again. But really, it was back to its normal level.
Okay.
And is that true or false?
Well, I think it's partly true and partly a little I don't know how to say it.
Every time they came on the radio, oh, our funding's been cut, funding's been cut.
Can I just...
They never represented that their funding had been increased and then decreased.
Okay, let me answer the question then.
Find out the truth. And then the other fact is...
What actually happened is we didn't actually add staff at that point. The Campbells very graciously donated money to build Campbell Hall for Public Telecommunication, which is obviously a blessing to WILL. And it did, as you say, result in increased federal funding by virtue of the matching fund program that they've got available, and that expired within 5 years. So we returned to a previous level of matching funds from the federal
government.
Why did
I have to dig around to find that? Why did I have to? Because WILL always was representing. Yeah, it had been cut. Sure, it had been cut, but it had been brought back to a regular level. Not, and the Campbells must have given you a pretty penny.
Well, let me just tell you what the accurate picture is of this. If you're talking about cuts in federal funding, those have been ongoing in addition to the cuts in state and university funding. So I think it's a little bit more complex than what you're describing. But, I think it's true that there was a period there where we were very blessed because of the Campbell's contribution to Campbell Hall. And we're very grateful, and that was it's a blessing to us, and we hope the entire community.
But why didn't you say that? Why is it that was not on the air? Why isn't that that truth, that fact that really made all the other ones come into clear view, that was nowhere? You were only concerned with your fundraising.
Well, I'm not really – I don't agree with that.
I don't know,
okay.
Jack.
Next
yeah,
question,
I'm not
– part. We can leave that one lay.
Yeah, well, caller,
fact. That is a fact.
Okay, well, caller, I'm not familiar with any of this. This call predates my experience here.
Okay,
but
how about the next question? How many more stations is the federal government funding than it used to? Like, even if it continued at regular rates of funding, if you have more stations eating at the same pie, the funding hasn't decreased. It actually has increased if we're funding more stations.
Well, I think that's another thing that we've talked about when we talked about fundraising. It's actually true that there are more public stations, and many of those are in rural areas and places that have been underserved and actually abandoned by other media operations, so that, public stations came in and for a very – very low cost established a community radio service. So, I mean,
Ben can speak with some authority on the empirical information.
The number of public stations has increased over the last few years, but it's misleading when you see the raw data, because not every station that's counted as a public broadcasting affiliate, whether in television and radio, is actually a physical station with transmitters and satellite dishes and studios. In a number of our more rural states, the stations are actually located in the urban centers, and then you have translator stations that are scattered throughout the rural area so that nobody misses the signal. And the translator station is really just a repeater of the signal that comes out of the urban center. So the amount of public federal appropriation for public broadcasting has declined over the past years in raw numbers and sort of leveled off over the last 4 to 5 years, but it has not increased relative to inflation, and it has not increased relative to the declining value of the dollar. So even a stagnation in the federal appropriation for public broadcasting is, in real terms, a budget shortfall for an individual station.
Hope that gets to the caller's question. We have full lines, so I want to go on to our next caller in Southern Illinois, line number one. Good morning.
Oh, I am another fan of WILL. I have listened for a long time, and it's just very important to me that you continue. I was wondering if anybody saw 60 Minutes yesterday when Mike Wallace was interviewing Putin, and he was asking him how he could allow just three networks to be government-controlled and how awful that was. And I was thinking of ABC, NBC, and CBS, and how I turn those channels on once in a while, and I see the same news over and over. It's just, to me, corporately fed. So I really appreciate WILL. I wanted to know if this conference tomorrow is going to be going anywhere else in the country. I heard something about St. Louis. I can't come tomorrow, and I was interested if it was going to be anywhere else, any discussion.
Well, the conference tomorrow and Wednesday, the Can Freedom of the Press Survive Media Consolidation here in Urbana, will be entirely taped and will be put up on the web very soon at the freepress.net website.
Okay.
And so you can probably Google that. But if you go to www.freepress.net, you'll find that information fairly soon. Likewise, and more importantly, the huge conference in St. Louis, which is going to be a major event with thousands of people, all of that will be up on the same website, the freepress.net website. And that's going to be a massive undertaking. What we're doing here is much simpler. We're simply here in Urbana, have one session at a time, three people speaking. There won't be competing sessions. There's no registration. Just come if you want. It's a pretty simple operation, 25 people or so coming from out of town. The St. Louis thing is a major, colossal undertaking with thousands.
When is that, sir?
That's Friday, Saturday, and Sunday this weekend. Once again, it will. If you go to the freepress.net website, you'll find out all about it. That's the best place to go.
Well, thank you, Mr. McChesney. I just hardly ever miss your show. And I wanted to know if WILL is strengthening its broadcasting signal, because in southern Illinois I get a lot of static a lot of times.
We do understand, and alas, we are restricted by our license to the power that we use, and there's not a lot we can do about that. However, I don't know if this offers any hope, but when we go to digital broadcasting in a few years, whenever that might be, then things are going to change, hopefully much for the better.
Well, thank you.
Thank you. Several callers waiting. We'll go next to Champaign County listener, line number two. Good morning.
Hi there.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to discuss more, for people to discuss more, the CPB chilling effect and the Tillotson and he's investigating now, which I understand didn't get any money from CPB. What's the standing of that? And then something about his meeting with DeLay, trying to change the way that CPB board was picked. And there have been a couple of removals of people, two women, one named Cox, one named Mitchell. I'm trying to sort them out. I think Cox was with PBS and Mitchell was with NPR. And the NPR stations have actually sent a letter saying that this isn't the right way to change personnel, if I recall. So some more about the pressure on the public broadcasting that we do have, if you would. Thanks.
Okay, Ben Scott, you want to tackle that?
Certainly. First, let me clear up the name game. Kathleen Cox was formerly the president of Corporation for Public Broadcasting. She has since been left rather abruptly, over, I think, in the last month. Pat Mitchell is currently the president of PBS. She has announced that she will not seek another term when her current term ends at the end of the year. Actually, I think she's in for another 18 months until the end of 2006. Ken Tomlinson is the chairman of the board of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. There are 9 members of the board currently. There are 2 vacancies. The board of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting is appointed by the White House. Historically, the board has functioned and self-identified as a quote-unquote heat shield that sits between Congress and PBS and NPR, the notion being that the federal government appropriates funds to public broadcasting, but we don't want that money to come with political strings attached to it. So the idea is you create the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, you appoint a number of unimpeachable characters to the board of directors, and that board allocates the funding to PBS and NPR, which remain independent of the political pressures from Congress. Now, obviously, it hasn't worked out quite so nicely as they intended. And now, ironically, the chairman of the board of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, Ken Tomlinson, has taken it upon himself to influence public broadcasting with a political point of view. He did indeed, as the New York Times reported a week or so ago, secretly hire someone to monitor Bill Moyers' program Now. Bill Moyers, of course, is no longer the host of Now. He's retired. And Now, as the caller correctly points out, takes no money from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. At the same time as Tomlinson was monitoring Bill Moyers for a so-called anti-Republican bias, he was lining up corporate sponsorship for the new program on public broadcasting, Paul Gigot's Wall Street Journal Roundtable, which is now on TV, to supposedly balance out Bill Moyers. who is no longer on television. At the same time, Tomlinson contracted with a White House staffer to produce a set of guidelines for the future of public broadcasting that he could use to present ideas to his fellow board members and to the executives of public broadcasting. These are all worrying developments. I don't want to go so far as to say that, you know, there's a conspiracy afoot and we're about to see the total collapse of public broadcasting or the foxification of public broadcasting. We're not there yet. We're a long way from there. But we do need to wake up and recognize that things are going on in Washington that we ought to take note of at the local level. This is our public broadcasting system. These are our stations. It's time that we made common cause with our station managers and told the higher-ups, both in the executives at the networks and also in the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, that they better listen to the public, and that's their job, and that's who they're accountable to.
We have about 5 minutes left during this hour of Focus 580 with Bob McChesney, professor of research, professor at the Institute of Communications Research, a lot of words in that title,
yeah,
at the University of Illinois, and also Ben Scott, policy director of the Free Press, discussing a conference which kicks off tomorrow, the conference titled Can Freedom of the Press Survive Media Consolidation? This is free and open to the public, and it gets started at 5 p.m. tomorrow with Seymour Hersh, the Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter, speaking at Folinger Auditorium, and no registration is required, so if you'd like to attend, you certainly can. We have several callers. We'll try to get to as many as we can. And next up, a listener in Kankakee on line number 3. Good morning.
This conference should prove to be an highly important contribution in the most significant area. What are the chances that transcripts as well as sound files could go up on freepress.net?
Well, yeah, you know, we'll do our best. I mean, you have no idea how understaffed we are. That's basically if I'm going to do it.
Yeah.
We'll see what we can do. I think that's a great idea. But we certainly will have sound files up at the very least, and we'd like to get transcripts.
Okay. Well, we'll go on to another caller. Aurora, line number 4. Good morning.
Yeah, I know I'm taking this in a different direction. I'm just really interested, and I want to say ditto to the woman who said that she was very much a member of WILL. I just love the programs. Do you know in Europe, and I realize I'm taking this overseas, how many is there free press? I'm especially interested in Slovakia, because I am Slovak, and I understand you cannot send papers, newspapers, magazines. You cannot send a lot of papers over to Europe, to Slovakia. And the people cannot come out of that country because once they come out with green cards, they stay here in America. They don't go back.
You know, I think I can't say anything intelligent about that right now, so maybe we should get that last caller in.
Okay.
So
I'm sorry.
Unintelligent.
You know, it's an issue that perhaps we could explore in another program.
Yeah, it's actually it's a lot of great issues on global media censorship and policies I'd love to talk about, but to open that kettle right here gets us well into your next guest.
Okay. All right. Sorry, we couldn't help you with that. We do have one remaining caller in Urbana, line number 1. Good morning.
Hi, Bob. Hi, Ben. I want to thank you for all your good work. And I'm just wondering if you could, I'd like to make the distinction between, our local, PBS affiliate and, National Public Radio. I'm wondering if you could comment on why, National Public Radio news has been, in my view, so close to the corporate news, when it deals with the war on Iraq. Can you talk about that? I mean, I have a friend who refers to it as National Pentagon Radio, and I'm afraid I agree with him.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. And I think that there's a couple of factors going on there. One is that the journalism at the national level for NPR is very much professional journalism as it's evolved in commercial environments. So they follow the same cues as NBC journalists. They get the same sources. They rely on the White House to the same extent. And I think that's the core of the problem there. And I that's going to be a tough problem to break. That goes beyond simply giving more money to public broadcasting. I think, though, at the same time, what my experience is that the listeners and viewers of the public system are much more open to critical views than the top management. And so the more we can get people around the country to say, look, we want more critical voices in public broadcasting. And that's what I think the people of the country would say. That can put pressure on these managers in Washington who are very hesitant to do anything that's going to get them in political hot water. And the closer you get to home on stories of political importance, like going to war in a country, the more sensitive managers are not to ruffle the feathers, because the last thing they want is the Bush administration pissed off at them when the budget's coming before Congress.
Yeah, well, I mean, I see it as a real problem because we have, we have very good locally based, locally developed programming here, and then we have this news stream that I just turn off because it's so poor. The national public radio news stream, and I will turn to WEFT to listen to the news on there because it's much more international and much better.
Yeah, I agree, and I think the only solution in the near term is what we've got to do is put heat from the bottom up and say, look, we want broader voices. We want to hear more. They're doing it at some NPR stations. We like it. The reason why you're doing this isn't because you're serving the public. You're doing it because you're afraid of the politicians who are doing this stuff behind closed doors, and that's got to end.
I'm sorry to say we're out of time. We have about a minute left. I want to make sure that we use that minute to have you say something about the conference, where people can get more information, and make sure people know they are free to attend.
Yeah. Once again, the conference, Can Freedom of the Press Survive Media Consolidation, Tuesday night, Folinger, 5 o'clock, Seymour Hersh, 7:30. Really an amazing lineup. Amy Goodman, Naomi Klein, and Representative Bernie Sanders, three extraordinary public figures and speakers. Then all day Wednesday, starting at 9 a.m., going until 5 p.m. in the Krannert Festival Theater. We've got the first session will be Seymour Hersh, Danny Goldberg, Linda Foley. The second session's going to be Phil Donahue, John Nichols, Naomi Klein. That's at 10:45. Then the afternoon sessions include Ben Scott, who's with me here, in the final session with Amy Goodman and Bill Fletcher. And then the 1:45 session, Dennis Swanson, Len Hill, Paul Jay, and Roberta Baskin. I think it's an issue as time has come. It's an issue clearly people care about, to wit, the callers we get, how my program's done on the air here. And this is a chance for people to get up to speed on the issues from some of the most important thinkers on this topic in the United States today.
Okay. Well, thanks so much to both of you. Bob McChesney, professor at the Institute of Communications Research at the University of Illinois, also host of Media Matters on WILL AM, and Ben Scott, policy director at the Free Press. Thanks so much.
Our pleasure.